Good evening, everybody. It is marvelous to see you tonight. All right, Paul plants the Corinthian church in March of 50 AD. He's on his second missionary journey. He receives what is called the Macedonian call, changes his itinerary, heads over to Greece, the northern part of Greece, which is called Macedonia. It's the first entry of the gospel into Europe. He goes to Philippi, he goes over to Thessalonica, heads over to Berea, down to Athens, where things don't go particularly well, and then he stays for a year and a half in Corinth. He finally leaves Corinth, sets up base in Ephesus, and 7 years later, he receives word that the Corinthian church is not doing well. They've just gotten off mission, they've gotten off track. So he writes them a letter to try to get them back on track, and they completely reject it. So what we call 1 Corinthians is Paul's second letter to the church at Corinth, and what we call 2 Corinthians is Paul's third letter to the church of Corinth. What is his big beef? It's simply this. Rather than becoming a thriving and vital church, the congregation had digressed into a reflection of the larger culture. This is a church that had unbelievable potential, and they were squandering it. Now, last week, I offered two dueling metaphors that would have been burned into the hard drive of Paul. First was a runner in the Isthmian Games who is running in perfect coordination. Every part of that runner's body are working together in coordination for maximum speed. That's juxtaposed with the temple slash hospital slash health spa that they called the Temple of Asclepius, where various and sundry body parts would have been hanging all over the place. And the idea was you ought to be like the athlete, but you're more like all of these body parts that are just hanging around. You have all of the gifts, you have all of the parts, but you're not using them in coordination with one another. Cotter Conlon, in his book 180 Degree Christian, points out six characteristics that threatened the Corinthian church. And when I look at these, I really think these are things that threaten the American church today. Number one, the elevation of people. So we lift people up and put them in the seat where only Christ should be. Number two, allowing false teachers. So there was no discrimination in terms of what was being taught. If you were talented enough, you could just say anything you wanted. Number three, unwillingness to hear the truth. This is a congregation that didn't ever want their toes stepped on in any way. If it wasn't making them feel good, they didn't want any part of it. Number four, false spiritual identity. Now, I want to be very clear about this. As Christian people, if our identity is not in Christ alone, our identity is in the wrong thing. It's in the wrong thing. So they had a false spiritual identity. Their identity was in being Corinthian, not being Christ. Number five, there was a toleration of sin. There was a toleration of sin in the church, and there was even high profile sin in the church. And number six is a lack of compassion. They just didn't care. They didn't care about the poor. They didn't care about the sick. They didn't care about people who were hurting. They just didn't care. If Conlon offers a diagnosis of the church, Paul offers a prescription. And the prescription is simply love. The idea is that when love finds its proper place in the church, lesser things find their proper place. So we talk about love a lot today, but I'm not really talking about love as we define it. I'm talking about love as the Bible defines it. And I think there's four clarifying characteristics of love that we got to get at in the Bible. Number one is the Greek word for love is agape. Agape is one of four Greek words that can be translated love. The Greeks broke love into four categories. There was phileo, friendship love, storge, which is family love. It's what I call Thanksgiving dinner love. There was eros, which is erotic love, but it had gotten to be a bad word, so it wasn't used in the Bible. And then there is agape. Agape is God love. It's a purely Christian concept of love. I consider love to be the most inadequate word in the English language, and I think it's the most misunderstood and most misappropriated word in the Bible. So agape, number two. This passage is normally applied out of context. When you hear 1 Corinthians 13, people often use it at weddings. But it's really not about that kind of love. It's about the reality that the gifts of the Holy Spirit thrive in an environment of agape on one hand, and without agape, the gifts are of no value on the other. The word agape is distinctly Christian. I think we could define it as unconditional love, sacrificial love, altruistic love. It's used 116 times in the New Testament. It is love with no strings attached. It's more an act of will than a feeling. It is the love you choose, not the love you feel. It is sacrificial in nature. It's always aimed at the highest good of the beloved. It's best illustrated by Christ's willingness to die for the sins of humanity. That is the ultimate expression of agape love. Number three, the Corinthian church had significant gifts, but they lacked love. Paul is saying, you people frustrate me to no end. Not because you're a terrible church, but because you should be a great church. I want to have proper theological positions, and I want to have proper biblical convictions. But if those positions that I hold are not held in love, they're not truly Christian. You see, a lot of times we think Christian just means being right no matter how ugly you are about it. But being Christian also has to do with just being loving. It doesn't mean you don't hold positions. It doesn't mean you don't stand for things. But what we do must be done in love. And I want to suggest that a lot of damage is done in the name of Christianity by people who are a whole lot more concerned about being right than they are being loving. And I want to be both. I really do. I want to be both. You also need to understand that sometimes love is tough love. Love's not always just permissive love. Bad parenting is permissive. Just let the kids do whatever they want. You're going to not end up where you want to be there. God's love is sometimes tough love, but because it's agape love, it always, always holds God's best for the person as the end game. And then number four, the church desired the gifts of the Spirit more than the fruit of the Spirit. The gifts were the power gifts, being able to speak really well, being able to heal people, being able to do things like speak in tongues. Those were kind of the gifts that were flying around. And everybody wants these high-profile gifts. But the fruit of the Spirit was about virtues. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, meekness, temperance, faith. Those aren't flashy things. Those aren't flashy things, but they're the things that give us character as Christians. So the church wanted all of the glitz and all of the bling, but they didn't want the solid character that it takes to uphold them. So, verse 1. If I could speak with the tongues of men and angels, but don't have love, I'm just making noise. And really what he's saying here is I'm not just only making noise, I'm making annoying noise. When my kids were little, my son Zach, when he was about 5 or 6, maybe he was 3, I don't know, it's all the same. But he was a little kid, all right? He was a little kid, and somebody got him a drum, like a drum for Christmas, one of the grandparents. And he opened it, and I said, that is awesome, it stays here. It's not going home with us. Because this is not what I'm going to listen to all day long, every day. That's not it. And I always used to tell the grandparents, get them what you want, but if anything is annoying to me, it stays at your house. You just need to understand it. What's Paul saying? If there's not love in our giftedness, we're just annoying. We're just annoying. The Corinthian church had told Paul part of their problem with him was that he wasn't a great pulpit preacher. And Paul replies, even if I was more eloquent than the golden tongues of the angels, if I didn't have love, I am just making noise. He's saying if you lack love, it doesn't matter how much giftedness you have, it is of no account. And the double ring is that those possessing the more sought after gifts of tongues in the church were no more than noisemakers without love. Why the infatuation with tongues? It's a great question, and I think it's because it was the initial gift of Pentecost. I think that's why the infatuation with tongues in the early church. Then he goes on to say, if I had the gift of prophecy, insight, knowledge, and faith, but lacked love, I would be nothing. So first you get the single gift, right? Great communication skills are less than love. But now he's saying extreme giftedness. I mean, if I'm like compound gifted, it's still less than love. He says, it doesn't matter how much talent you have. It doesn't matter how many spiritual gifts you have working. If it's not done in a context of love, then you're missing the mark. Verse 3, if I gave everything to the poor and became a martyr but lacked love, it would be for nothing. In a city consumed by the relentless pursuit of more, in an emerging faith that's being hotly persecuted by the Roman Empire, the people who would be most respected in the church would be the martyrs, the ones who gave everything for their faith in Christ. And Paul's saying, even the ultimate sacrifice, even if I gave all my money to the poor, and even if I give my life for this faith, it all comes to nothing if I don't love people. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, wrote, without this love, whatever I speak, whatever I have, whatever I know, whatever I do, whatever I suffer is nothing. Nothing. Verse 3. Now, let's move on. Paul likes lists. He loves to make lists, which is why I like preaching Paul. I mean, seriously. Paul preaches himself. You just have to illustrate. So those of you that like to take notes, you're about to, this is going to be the greatest thing of your life. Paul's going to give us 8 things love is not. And I'm just going to go right through the text, okay? Love is not jealous. In the way the word is translated in the Greek here, jealous is far less desiring what others have than being bitter about what you don't have. Okay? So it's far less desiring what others have is being bitter about what you don't have. That's jealous. Number 2, boastful. I find this really interesting. Have you ever noticed that couples who who are not in love often attempt to inflate themselves in the eyes of the other, but people who are in love tend to inflate the other in their own eyes? You get two people who aren't in love that they're on a date. One of them will try to inflate themselves in the eyes of the other. But when you're truly in love, you inflate the other in your own eyes. People not in love boast about themselves, trying to impress. They're like those lizards that kind of got the thing that goes, right? People who are in love don't do that. People who are in love boast about their beloved. A Christian who always talks about themselves and their giftedness is in love with themselves and their giftedness. A Christian who always talks about Christ is in love with Christ. So who do you talk about? Are you trying to inflate your Christianity in the eyes of other people? That's what people do that aren't in love with Jesus. Boastful. Number three, proud. Proud. The Corinthians were proud of things that didn't matter to God. And they lacked the things that truly mattered to God. William Barclay writes here, love is not inflated with its own importance. I like that. So proud is being connected, disconnected from what is important to God. So when I take great pride in something that doesn't matter to God, I'm in a bad place. Because my values are messed up. My values are offline. Pride is building ourselves up around things that don't matter to God. Now, let's take a look at this next one. Rude. I really think this is fascinating to me. The Greek word used here isn't very well definable. There's some Greek words you can't really define terribly well in English. But I can tell you this. It's the antonym of charming. Right? So let me just give you a good definition. Love is not charmless. It's not charmless. There's nothing as utterly charmless as a rude and self-centered person. I find that I'm pretty even-keeled most of the time. I don't tend to get upset because I don't have high expectations for things. Let me give you an example. I don't get upset when I drive because I have very low expectations for the driving ability of people around me. So if they pull out in front of me, I never felt there was a strong chance they were good drivers to start with. So I'm not upset about that. Does that make sense? I mean, I just have pretty low expectations. So if I went out and played golf, tonight I would freeze. But if I went out and played golf, I used to play golf all the time. I haven't really played golf in about 7 years. If I went out and played, there's no chance I'd get upset because there's no reason to think I should do well. There's just no rational reason to think I should do well. So if I went and played golf and I shot 120, it wouldn't bother me too much, particularly if I found six balls. Because the reality is I have no reason to expect that I would do well. There's no logical reason to expect that. So rude people are people that get bent out of shape about things and aren't worth getting bent out of shape about, but they're also the people that always press to the front of the line. I remember in kindergarten, we used to really get in trouble if you cut in line. You know, you guys ever in a line somewhere and somebody cuts in line? Don't you wish that like we were Vulcans and we could do that thing that Spock does when people just fall to the ground, just down they go, right? But you know, it's just rudeness. And I find that I'm level-headed and pretty even-keeled, but rude people just get on my last nerve. And it's the only time Melissa will have to say, Shane, don't say anything. And it's very difficult for me. And I'll tell you why, because I'm concerned that they'll go through their whole life thinking they're normal. And that just bothers me, because maybe nobody's ever loved or cared about them enough to say, you know what, you're really rude. And I'm happy to do that. And so love isn't rude. Love doesn't push itself up front. Number five, love is not demanding. Love does not ask, what can you do for me? Love asks, what I can do for you. You know, rude people are often demanding. And sometimes I get frustrated about this too. I hate to bare my soul tonight, but I eat out almost every morning and for lunch. And I eat out almost every morning. And I go to places where food is cheap in the morning, like McDonald's. And every now and then somebody will be in front of me and they're just reaming out the McDonald's worker. I'm sitting there thinking, this kid is 17 years old. I don't know what they're making, but it's not nearly enough to deal with you. And they probably have no idea what they're doing. And why would you just be so ugly to them? Why would you be so demanding? You know what? Demanding people, they think they're better than everybody else. They think their time's more valuable than everybody else's, and they view people as servants, and it drives me insane. You see, I was raised in a small town. We treated everybody really, really well, and it didn't matter who you were because we were all from DuCoin. And I was just brought up that you just treat people well. And love treats people well. It's not demanding. Number six, demanding, irritable. Boy, isn't that tough as you get older? How many of you find yourself getting more irritable as you get older? Boy, isn't that just bad, right? I mean, like one day, you know, hair starts growing in your ears, and the next day you're irritable. It's terrible. It's terrible. But what it's really saying here is that love isn't in a bad mood. Love isn't in a bad mood. I really like that. Number seven, love doesn't keep score. The Greek word here is an accounting term, and it means love doesn't make permanent entries into a ledger. Love writes in pencil because sometimes you just got to erase stuff. And I just want to just suggest to you, maybe in this Christmas season, if you want something, a great gift to give yourself, I'm not talking about others, give yourself, get yourself a good eraser and erase some of the entries you've made in the ledger where you feel like people have trespassed against you. Not to let them off the hook because they don't care. You know, I read a great quote today. Winston Churchill, English prime minister into World War II. I love this. He says, when you're 20, you care what other people think. When you're 40, you don't care what other people think. And when you're 60, you realize nobody thinks about you at all. And I think there's really a lot of truth. How many times do we spend just ruminating, obsessing, being bitter about things that people have done to us, and they don't think about us at all? They're not losing one wink of sleep over us. They don't think about us at all. My mom, it is so funny, about 3 or 4 years ago, there was an announcer on TV, and my mom just really didn't like this announcer. And mom said to me, she said, Shane, I really don't like this announcer, and it's really, really bothering me. And I said, Mom, I just hate to tell you this, but that announcer doesn't think about you at all. I mean, not at all. So you just kind of need to let that one go. Get out the eraser. Erase that, man. Love doesn't keep score. Love has a short memory. And since it doesn't write down wrongs, they're easy to forget. I find I'm at an age where 100% of the things I do right now get done. And then as you move out from there, less percentages of them get done all the time. If I don't make a note, it's probably not going to happen. And I hate that, but it's increasingly true. So when people disappoint you, and they will, and even when you disappoint yourself, and you will, just don't write it down. And if you do, write it down in pencil really light, like you used to do on old passports where you had to put your address down where you're going to be in a foreign country. You always wanted to write that really light because you're going to have to erase it later. Think like that. Number eight, love is not glad about injustice. Love is never happy when wrong is done. Love isn't even happy when wrong is done to evil people. Love has a sense of justice about it. Now, in typical Pauline fashion, Paul loves to juxtapose lists. So he's told us what love isn't, so guess what he does now? He tells us what love is. So let's talk about eight things love is. Number one, love is patient. Love is patient. The Greek word here does not mean patient with circumstances. It means patient with people. It spins on how God is patient with a sinful humanity and then requires that God's people extend that kind of patience to their neighbors. And so when I really get into the Greek here and when I really get into the text, I think what this is really saying is love is slow to give up on somebody. It's slow to give up on somebody, and it's slow to give up on something. That's patience. Number two,
Love is kind. Love treats others well. But it goes beyond treating people who treat us well, well. It's about treating people who could never do anything for us well. Christmas, I think it's one good thing to think about. I've noticed the Salvation Army has made some commercials this year. And it's fascinating to me, but the commercials this year for the Salvation Army aren't just asking for money. They're telling us what the Salvation Army does. And I think for a couple of decades, the Salvation Army just assumed that we all knew what they did. And I don't think we did. And now they're just telling us what they do. And I thought, that is brilliant, because guess what they do? Kind stuff. They do kind stuff. Well, who doesn't want to be a part of that? Just because somebody's ringing a bell and standing in the cold does not compel me to give. But if I'm giving toward kindness, that's different. Number three, love loves the truth. It rejoices when the truth comes out, even when the truth is painful. Love rejoices in truth. I love number four. Love is relentless. It just never gives up. Love is stubborn. It refuses to give up on taking God at his word. It refuses to give up on believing the best about people. There's this relentless nature to love. Number five, love is faith-keeping. The ability to maintain optimistic beliefs despite significant stressors. Sometimes we think our most effective testimony is when everything is going our way, but the reality is no one can relate to that. What people relate to is when you're going through a really, really difficult time and you're still faithful to God. That's what impresses people. Love keeps faith. It keeps faith. It protects faith. Number six, love is hopeful. That's what I'm going to be preaching on this Christmas season. I love, there's certain sayings I just love, but one of my favorite sayings is, I can't wait until tomorrow because I get better looking every day. I just absolutely love that. The reality is that if we're Christian people, God wins. And the long-term forecast is excellent. Short-term forecast might be dicey. Long-term forecast is excellent. I have looked at the back of the book, and God wins. I'm reading this book right now. I read biographies, and I'm reading a book on Andrew Jackson. And the reason I'm reading a book on Andrew Jackson is because I don't like Andrew Jackson. So I thought if I better understood Andrew Jackson, that would be helpful to me as an historian. So I'm reading this book on Andrew Jackson, and frankly, it's really cool, but it's on the Battle of New Orleans. And you know what? I'm about 3/4 of the way through it, and I would bet $1 million right now there's no way Andrew Jackson's going to be able to hold New Orleans. There's no way he's going to be able to defeat the British in New Orleans. They've just defeated his fleet. They've got the upper hand. There's no way Andrew Jackson is going to be able to bring a bunch of groups of people together, including pirates, and get them all on the same page. There's no way he's going to do that. But guess what I know? Andrew Jackson won the Battle of New Orleans. And no matter what I'm going through when I'm reading that book, I still know in my heart how that story ends. He won the Battle of New Orleans. Life is like that for Christian people. It doesn't matter how bad things seem right now. You still know how the story ends, and God wins. And if we're on God's side, we're on the winning team. Several years ago, when I thought I was a Rams fan, and in reality I was a Kurt Warner fan, Kurt Warner got traded to the Giants, where he didn't play much, and then he went to the Cardinals, ironically, and had a resurgence of his career. And I loved Kurt Warner. I just loved following him. And there would be times when I would obviously be in church or have meetings on Sundays, and I would tape the games. But a lot of times I would hear what the score was before the game ended. And it was so interesting. I always rooted for the Cardinals to win back in those days. But the reality is, it didn't matter if the Cardinals were down 28 points in the second quarter. If I knew that they won, I wasn't stressed about it because I knew how the thing ended. And it's the same thing in our lives. We know how the thing ends. Evil is vanquished. God wins. And if we're on his side, we win too. That's why we can be hopeful people. Hope is embedded in this faith of ours. Number 7, love is enduring. The Greek concept of endurance was that the adversity that might destroy many make the great. I'm sorry. The adversity that may destroy many make the few great. The adversity that could destroy 99 athletes makes that 100th athlete the best athlete ever. There's a conquering element to biblical endurance. I can't tell you how many setbacks I had on my early ministry journey. I can't tell you how many that I had. And each one presented a temptation to give up. But had I given up, I would have missed everything that God has done since. And when I look back to a lot of those difficult times, I see that God produced things in me that I don't think would have gotten produced any other way. And it doesn't mean I think back fondly of those times, but I do see God's hand in them. And that's a part of endurance. And I think the idea here is that as Christian people, we're not just gutting out the race, we're going to win this thing. We're going to win this thing. Number 8, love is eternal. There's only one biblical teacher more animate than Paul about parsing temporary things from the eternal, and that was Jesus Christ. And so here's the big idea of love. You got to play for the end game. Several years ago, I had a good friend, and this friend was estranged from his wife. They were having a lot of problems. And he came to me, we sat down together and we were talking. And I just looked at him and I said, "What do you hope happens 3 years from now?" And he looked at me and he said, "I hope we're reconciled and happy." I said, "Then don't do anything right now that could keep that from happening. Play for the end game. Play for the end game. Love plays for the end game." Have you ever been rankled about something, but you knew your feelings were unsustainable? Man, I have. I've had times in my life where I just was so frustrated with somebody or so frustrated about something, but I would think the whole time, "I'm really upset about this, but I can't live like this. And if I do, I won't live long like this." It's unsustainable. So what I want to say is we got to love plays for that end game. We got to play for the end game. And a great question to ask if you're in a cross-thread relationship with somebody right now is what do you hope happens 3 years from now or 5 years from now? Make sure you don't do anything that's going to keep that from happening or make that more difficult to happen. Verse 11, "When I was a child, I talked and thought like a child, but when I grew up, I put away childish things." We have this wonderful idea of children, and I get that because kids are great. Christmas is cool. You look through the eyes of a kid at Christmas. But let me tell you something about kids. I've never heard anybody say this. "My kid's really cute, but what's even more impressive is my kid gets the big picture." No one has ever said that in the entire world. Kids don't get the big picture. They just don't get the big picture. All they see is what affects them. When I was a boy in Pinckneyville, Illinois, many of you probably vacationed there, but when I was a boy in Pinckneyville, Illinois, we could be in the middle of a summer drought, and there could be storm clouds in the sky, and it had not rained for 8 weeks, and guess what I was praying? That my baseball game wouldn't get rained out. It's a child's prayer, right? There were farmers all around me who were praying for their livelihood, that was going to produce rain. And I'm praying there, hoping my baseball game doesn't get rained out. That is a child's prayer. Paul says, "When I was a child, I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. I acted like a child. But when I grew up, I put away childish things. I saw the big picture. I realize it's not all about me. It's not about my baseball game. There's something bigger than me going on in this world. What's Paul saying? Corinthian church, you're just going to have to grow up. You're just going to have to grow up. Verse 12, we don't see things as they actually are, but there will be a day when we will. I learned long ago that what is said is not always what's heard. And what I think and what I feel is not always real. You guys know what I'm talking about? It's not always real. I think about so many people who come to dire straits in their lives, and everything in their head, everything in their emotion is speaking falseness to them. And if they can just get through that period, they might be fine. But we got to understand that we don't always see things as they actually are. But one day we will. One day we will. Paul points to a day when people will be fully connected with the truth. And the clouds of all of our doubt will be driven away. When we're going to get it. You see, my friends, when you learn to see yourself as Christ sees you, you're starting to get it. And when you learn to see yourself as Christ sees you, all of a sudden you stop hating yourself. And you stop looking at yourself for every failure you've ever made. But when you see yourself as Christ sees you, you start seeing yourself as somebody that God valued so much that he sent his only son to save. We look at what we are and we look at how we've messed up. God looks at what we could be. We're loved. We got to start seeing the reality of that. Verse 13, at the end of it all, only faith, hope, and love will remain. And the greatest of these, drum roll please, is love. The greatest of these is love. As Paul concludes his treatise, he boils everything down to faith, hope, and love. He contrasts that with the spiritual gifts like tongues and prophecies, which he says are temporary. He says these three virtues are eternal. They are the virtues of heaven. They're not special gifts given to the church during the time between when Christ ascended and Christ will return. That's the spiritual gifts. But the fruit of the Spirit are eternal things. What is faith? Faith is believing in what you can't see. Hope is keeping faith alive, even when it's hard. And love is a true commitment to a greater good. So love is deemed the greatest because love is the highest aim of faith and the most true expression of hope. Love is what faith believes in, and love is what hope hopes for. So, seven closing thoughts on Thrive for the whole series all wraps down to this. Here we go. Gifts are given for the church and not the individual. So your gifts are not given for you so everyone can say how wonderful you are. And I'm all for you being wonderful. But that's not why the gifts are given. The gifts are given for the church. They are given for the body, not for the individual. Have you ever seen somebody who only works out one area of their body? These are some of my favorite people. I always want to take selfies with them. Have you ever seen somebody, for example, let's just say biceps. You can tell they don't exercise at all, but they have biceps this big. Their legs are like this big, but they got these huge biceps. And they walk around like this, and they wear shirts that are like torn to shreds, and they walk around like that. And what I think is, I think, wow, that is really one built-up part of the body to the neglect of all others. That's not what the church is to be. The church is to be a body coordinated that's all built up for the purpose of not the individual, but the purpose of the whole. Number two, discover your gifts. Discover your gifts. I don't know what they are, but you won't find them until you put them into play. So volunteer for something. Get involved in something. You say, well, I don't know what I'm good at. Well, find something you wouldn't mind doing. And just give it a shot. You don't know till you get out there. When I was in high school, we had a guy that high jumped. His name was Jim. And Jim was like the best high jumper my high school had ever seen, but they didn't discover it until his sophomore year. And nobody really realized Jim could jump high. And we were in PE one day, and they were doing like track and field in PE, which is like, you know, kind of like a punishment for regular kids. And then they were doing track and field in PE, and then somebody kind of showed him how to high jump. And all of a sudden, this guy's like jumping 6'4". And the rest of us are going, who would have thought it? Well, here's the deal. Had he not tried and put those gifts into play, nobody would have ever found out he was a good high jumper and he was the best we ever had in our high school. But nobody would have known had he not given it a shot. So here's what I'm just saying. Give it a shot. Give something a shot. Get involved in something. Who knows? Might be your thing. You might be a great high jumper. Number three, use your gifts. Don't just discover them. Use them. Use them. They grow with use. It's just like exercising. The body parts that we work out, they get stronger and they grow with use. So use your gifts. Number three, four, coordinate with the gifts of others. It's not all about you. It's not all about you. If you're upset about me, 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 you're missing the whole point of the gospel. It's about the body. It's about the team. It's about what God wants to do through us collectively, not what God is going to do through you individually. Number five, grow from failure and disappointment. Grow from it. John Maxwell, who's kind of the leader in leadership kind of guru, he wrote a book a while back called Failing Forward. And the whole idea is even when you fail, how do you fail in a way that you develop a learning curve, that you grow from it, that you're better on the other side of it? I love the definition in Proverbs, which I'll be doing once we get to January. I love the definition of a good man in Proverbs. It says, though a good man falls seven times, he'll get back up again. Good people fall sometimes, but they get back up again. So you're going to use your gifts, and sometimes it's not going to go terribly well. I remember my first sermon. I still have it on a cassette tape, and I listen to it every now and then when I need humbled. It was terrible. I mean, it was terrible. And how anybody could have ever imagined I could be used by God in that way is unbelievable to me. It was just terrible. But you know what? I gave it a shot, and I kept giving it a shot, and people would say, I'd say, what'd you think of my sermon? They say, well, you know, you're kind of like obnoxious, and you kind of miss the whole point, and you're kind of angry, and before long, you kind of listen, and you kind of grow from your failure and your disappointment. And God can kind of get a little something going. But what you can't do is you can't just get all full of pride and decide you're going to take your ball and go home. You can't do that because you'll go home, nobody else will care, and you'll miss what God's doing. Number six, keep the big picture in mind. We don't have any trouble keeping the part of the relief with our pictures in it in mind. But the reality is God's got a great big picture, and we're just a small part of that. Keep the big picture in mind. And sometimes we have to sacrifice for the team. Sometimes we have to become lesser that the team becomes greater. These are difficult things sometimes, but keep the big picture in mind. And finally, number seven, keep your eyes on Jesus. Keep your eyes on Jesus. The Corinthian church got their eyes off of Jesus, and they got them onto people, and they got them onto being successful and all those things. And I don't want to be critical of us, but we got to make sure we don't do that. You know, you can hold up all of these accolades that have come our way in the past several years, and you can say, well, we were this, and we were this, and we were recognized as this, and this, and this, and this, and all that's got nice, and all that's good and well. But if that becomes our identity, we have an identity based on something other than Christ. And if that becomes what we have our eyes on, it becomes something other than Christ. It's not about how great a church we are. It's about how great is this Christ that we serve. That's what this is all about. So keep your eyes on Jesus. Don't get your eyes on yourself. Don't get your eyes on yourself. You ever notice these modern phones? You can take a picture, and then if you want to point it at yourself, you just hit a button and it flips it around. It's kind of firing right at you. That's what we need to never do as Christians. We need to never hit that button where it's just firing back on us, because it's not about us. We're just small parts of something far greater than ourselves. We're just one tree in an endless forest of trees, each having sacrificed a part of itself to be a part of something greater. So what's the key here? What's the key here as I wrap this up? This is the key. Coming into union with Christ. And if this was really cool, I would go like this, and these things would go together, but this isn't cool. All right? It's cool, but it's not as cool as I wish it were. All right? But this is the idea. Imagine this is Jesus, and this is us. This is the part of our lives that are in union with Jesus. What is the key to thriving as Christians? It's continually bringing ourselves. Imagine that this is moving. Those of you on Facebook, imagine that this is moving. Imagine that this is moving in. The key is it bringing ourselves into complete union with Christ. Giving up our selfishness, our insecurities, our strengths, our weaknesses. Giving everything up for the greater cause of Christ. It's always sacrificial. It's always difficult, and it's absolutely essential if we're going to be an effective church. What's interesting is it's not the kind of thing one or two people have to decide. We all have to decide. We all have to decide that we're going to be a part of God's team and a part of God's church. Would you join me in a closing prayer for this series? And I'm just going to invite you to open your eyes and say it with me. Almighty God, thank you for what you have taught us about thriving. Thank you for your presence in our lives and the gifts you have given to your church. Forgive us where we have taken our eyes off of Jesus and fixed them on lesser things. Jesus, come into our lives fresh and new. Fill us with your Spirit and your power. As we use our gifts for you, use us for your glory. And most of all, may all we do be done in love. In Jesus' strong name, and all God's people said, amen.